Universalist Community Church of Hendricks County. My name is Dave Cravata. The song I chose for tonight was Schism by the band Tool. We are a progressive congregation consisting of people of many beliefs, some with a religious background, some with none, some who believe in a God, some who do not. Our beliefs are diverse but inclusive. We have no shared creed, but instead a shared covenant, including our seven principles, which you'll find posted on the wall. Whatever your faith, whomever you love, we welcome you with all your truths and your doubts, your worries and your hopes. We are a community that embraces freedom of thought, where people come together to encourage each other to spiritual growth that makes for peace, ethical living, and community service. During these Chautauqua sessions, a collection plate will not be passed, but donations are graciously accepted. Donation plates are located on the back table near the entrance, and on the small table near the door leading to our fellowship hall. If you have any questions about our church, feel free to explore the literature on the tables. You can also speak with any of us wearing a name tag, or even those of us without wearing a name tag. And now I turn things over to Sam Carmen, who will serve as our moderator this evening.
Thanks, Dave. Good evening. Charlotte Bronte once wrote, "Prejudices are most difficult to eradicate from the heart whose soil has never been loosened or fertilized by education. They grow there firm as weeds among stones." About education, Nelson Mandela said, "It is the most powerful weapon which you can use to change the world." Our speaker this evening is going to share his thoughts about education in his address, Education, the True Corrective of Abuse. Matt Impink earned a Bachelor of Arts degree in Sociology from the University of Pennsylvania, as well as certification in secondary teaching. He taught high school U.S. history in Southwest Philadelphia before coming to Indiana to earn a Master of Public Affairs degree from IUPUI. He has served as communications and policy consultant for the Lumina Foundation for Education and director of policy and civic engagement for the Indy Chamber. Matt currently serves as executive director of Indy Achieves and is responsible for building this initiative to serve Marion County students who are seeking a post-secondary degree or credential. Please join me in welcoming Matt Impink.
All right, good evening, everyone. Good evening. Sam, I very much appreciate the warm introduction, and it's good to see some familiar faces. I very much want to kind of dive into some interesting things I've been thinking about around education. Please, I ask you, I beg your forgiveness for any ways this is disconnected or not making any sense. I'll try to clean that up as best I can with any questions you guys have. So I'll go ahead and get started, and Phil tells me that I should expect to speak for about a half hour, and then we'll get into some questions afterwards. So look forward to that. Once again, good evening. My name is Matt Impink. I very much appreciate the opportunity to speak to you here tonight. It's not every day you get the chance to share your thoughts on meaningful topics, and even more so as a young person. I regrettably can't say that for too much longer, because I'm 34 years old. And about the age every young group that I belong to is unceremoniously kicking me out. My daughter, who is with us tonight, who you'll probably hear at some point, is certainly not helping any lingering feelings of youth that come upon me from time to time. I'm very fortunate and truly humbled to be asked by my friend Phil Gully to join you here tonight. I've known Phil since I was 18 years old. Do you believe that, Phil? When I was invited by a friend to attend Fairfield Friends meeting and have long since admired his gift for rhetoric and wit, that I try and emulate myself, and I'll do my best here tonight. His remarks are what? What's that?
I think you can do better than that.
We'll see about that. Phil's remarks are what I think of and sometimes call high Hoosier, along the same lines of high culture or high holidays. I myself am a Hoosier through and through, having grown up here in Indiana, and despite the fact that I now live in downtown Indianapolis. That was a joke for you Hendricks County folks. I have the pleasure to serve as the first executive director of Indy Achieves, Mayor Hogsett's initiative to close the post-secondary attainment gap in Marion County. We need to do that in order to meet the demand for talented workers to fill 21st century jobs in our community. We provide promise scholarships, meaning if they have any gap in their ability to pay their tuition and fees at Ivy Tech or IEPUI, we'll provide a scholarship to close whatever that gap is, and other kinds of wraparound services. It is truly my honor to serve in this role and gives me the rare opportunity in life to shape an institution at its foundation. And as you'll probably hear, I've been thinking about this a lot lately and what decisions we make that set the course of how things are gonna follow afterwards. Tonight, I hope to reflect on the role of education in our society and what ways it paves the way for greater civic dialogue and understanding and a bit of how it falls short. I will ask you all to consider how formal and informal education plays a role in shaping lives, how the foundation for such systems came to be, and when from time to time do we need to upend those systems and reshape them for the betterment of our community. I think we all need to be reflecting on that in what I think we can all say safely is a time of great turmoil in our country, and we need to be honest about that. I was told I need to be professorial tonight, so I'm bringing the big guns of a heavy quote to frame our conversation. Thomas Jefferson wrote that education was the true corrective of abuses of constitutional power. And I think there's great wisdom in that sentiment, but it deserves to be broken down. The scholarly way to approach this is to say a highly engaged society will demand sovereign power to govern ourselves as opposed to being ruled by tyrants. You can think about Thomas Jefferson and the founding fathers of that era trying to be the opposite of what they experienced under rule by Great Britain. But in order to do so, we need to have the knowledge necessary to understand our government and the way society operates. Many have reflected on the great task of our founders of our nation and what they had to build to form a democratic society. And like any group of nerds coming together to solve a problem, they looked at previous examples of governmental arrangements, hoping that someone before them had figured out how to not be ruled by a king. While they looked at ancient Athens and Rome and took lessons there, they honestly borrowed a lot from their own mostly Anglo heritage and tradition and reworked it to the needs of the time to create something pretty unique in the world, in our American system. We all have this simple challenge of arranging our lives in a way that makes sense for our needs and the lives of those around us. My wife and I have arranged a compromise in our household. She washes the clothes and I fold them. Seems like a really good arrangement, actually. Yeah, she approves. She embraces the chaos of mashing all the clothes together and then having them swirl around and round and around again into a mess. A clean mess, but a disorganized mess. She really embraces that, which I appreciate and love about her. Then she hands it off to me to make order out of the chaos while folding and hanging everything so that it fits perfectly in our closet. And I very much like that. Like my father, I'm a little anal retentive and I like things exactly the way they should be. At a certain point, I started putting all the hangers on clothes with the open end of the hanger on the right of the shirt. So just so you guys can visualize this, when you fold a, when you hang a shirt, you put the open end of the hanger up to the right, slide it in that way, and then put it on your chin, and okay, so just like that. So I've always done it that way. And when you hang it up, let me do it right here. And when you hang it up, there's a certain way that it hangs. And so when you hang a second shirt, you do it the same way, and it fits nicely right over the top of it, as opposed to trying to do it this way. And if you try to pull both the hangers off at the same time, you can't pull them off because they're both on them. That becomes a, and just because I'm like this, I'm gonna make sure it's right. So this meant that all the shirts hung in my closet are facing the same way. And if I had to move, as I often did before I met my wonderful wife, then I could remove many shirts from the rack all at once, because the opening was all facing the same way. Who is totally jiving on this level of I got some people who believe in this. Okay. Sorry, Tim?
The hangers are facing backwards, so that's the
only
problem.
Oh, see, this is great. This is great. I will address people of your belief in a moment, Sam. I will. I know it's totally not healthy sometimes, but I don't care. I know exactly when my wife has actually hung up something in the closet, because oftentimes it's hung up the wrong way. And it drives me crazy, but I love her, so I let it go. But because the shirt is shaped different from the ones there next to it, and it just gets a little crazy. You know, we like our environment the way we expect it. But we have to ask ourselves, why is putting the hanger to the left the wrong way? As it is, Sam, it is the wrong way. If I'm being honest, showing you a little grace here, Sam. If I'm being honest, and unfortunately my wife is here to say, hear me say this, it's perfectly conceivable that putting the hanger with the opening to the left is just as correct and frankly makes no difference as putting the hanger to the right. But the fact is that some of my shirts have been on my rack that I've worn in the last year, but really haven't. And they are hung there with the hanger with the opening to the right. And they aren't changing. They aren't. Those shirts aren't moving for another 5-6 years at least. And if you were to put a shirt right up next to it with the hanger with the opening to the left, it would throw off the whole rack. So in many ways, the way you choose at the beginning of arranging your closet, of putting the hangers to the left or the right, makes a big deal. If we stop and think about this, we have constructed many rules that govern our lives that have been decided in a fairly arbitrary manner. By show of hands, how many of you believe in your heart of hearts that the toilet paper roll should feed toilet paper from the top? Okay. We have some strong beliefs on this. I happen to believe that as well. I believe that very strongly. That's how you get the best and cleanest hair in the moment of truth. I believe this in every fiber of my being, that the toilet paper roll should not be put into the holder for the TP to be fed ever so frugally to me from the bottom. It's unnatural. Those of you who raised your hands, who are brothers and sisters in our struggle to make sure that toilet paper is fed from the top, thank you. Thank you. Social scientists call this a social construction. Those of you who have cats in your home might feel very differently, as one brave soul shared with me once and opened up to me to say that if you put your toilet paper roll so that it feeds from the top, that's just a great fun toy for a cat. By feeding it from the bottom, it's a simple and ingenious way to foil our feline friends from unfurling our toilet paper. Both sides can feel truth is on their side, and each can construct their meaning around it, whether it is around hangers, toilet papers, sports teams, language, or even things like immigration, or gun control, or partisan politics. We as a nation are constantly reconstructing the social constructions that we must navigate this treacherous ground, and we must navigate this treacherous ground very carefully. It is a rare opportunity to have a gathering of people coming together to be honest about our biases, whether it is about toilet paper or something with much higher stakes. If there is any great way to help people navigate our society effectively, it is through formal education. Once only a privilege of the ruling classes of society, the United States from the time of Thomas Jefferson forward has had the challenge of providing all Americans with the language for us all to be citizens in a democratic society. And language is one of the key ways formal systems of education have used to bring people together in our democratic society. Schools are where we learn that the hanger opening goes on the right, or that the letter A makes an ah sound, and that the letters A, P, P, L, E mean apple. It would be impossible to access the world and our society here in the United States without knowing these basic social constructions, even if people around the world call an apple something very different themselves. And they would be perfectly within their perspective to call it that. However, education is often also a way to erect barriers for people from other societies. It has provided both great opportunity for the masses and systematically oppressed people who are different. As the United States has absorbed many more and more people from different cultures, there has been a process of educating them on the social constructions decided long ago. These are people who might have thought it proper long ago to put the hanger on the left and lined up their shirts that way before someone came along to tell them that the opening on the hanger actually goes on the right. It means that they have to shed their past, and if you can imagine how hard it is to get rid of your old shirts that you used to love, or turn the hanger and rehang every shirt in your closet, imagine how hard it would be to not be able to see your family or talk to your grandmother. It's the price paid. It's the price paid to be able to argue your case in front of the Supreme Court. It's the price we pay to be able to get a job. It's the price we pay to be able to enjoy the bounty of our country. It is important to keep in mind that while my ancestors made that choice willingly to pay that price, many others have not made that choice willingly. Education occurs in formal systems and informal systems. Formal systems obviously include schools that have been a generous and necessary part of Indiana's history. And forgive me, because as was stated, I'm a former history teacher, so I'm going to go a little history nerdtastic on you here. In the year 1816, a group of mostly Southerners who migrated across the Ohio River and settled in the Northwest Territories formally petitioned the United States to join the Union as the state of Indiana. They gathered in Corydon, our first state capital, to write our state's constitution. Seeking shelter from the heat of the summer, the founding fathers went under the large elm tree in the yard outside the courthouse to write a remarkably progressive idea at that time into our state's constitution. It says, as soon as circumstances will permit, to provide by law for a general system of education ascending in regular gradation from township schools to a state university, wherein tuition shall be gratis and equally open to all. That's in our original state constitution.
Is it still in?
I'm going to ignore that little detail for the sake of my argument. but I see what you're doing there. Gratis or free and equally open to all. That's a very, I think, progressive and interesting idea for the founding of our state. This is a promise that we're still trying to keep to this day. Throughout our state's history, we've made the sacrifice to pay taxes at the township or municipal level to set aside funding for our public school system. And around the turn of the 20th century, in Indianapolis, for example, was going through a technological revolution as automobile factories were popping up all over the city. With cutting-edge technology, they began making cars with the names of Stutz and Dusseldorf and others. And these were changing society around the United States and soon to be around the world. And demand in these factories soared for workers. All of a sudden, these factories needed scores of workers who could read, write, and do basic math, so you could actually work in these factories. So communities decided, in Indianapolis in particular, to create a publicly funded training system to fuel that demand for workers. Today, we call this high school, and it's one of the most ubiquitous American experiences any one of us have. I believe the most common book in any American household is the Bible, and the second most common book in any American household is, can you guess? High school yearbook. In 2019, our generation is going through our own technological revolution. As we are no longer asking people to go out and turn the screw by and large, but we are asking our workers to program the machines to turn the screw for us. That is a reality, whether we like it or not, that is happening in our economy. By next year, experts predict that 62% of jobs will require some form of post-secondary education, while we as a state only have 42% of our population with a post-secondary degree or credential. At the same time, we need people with post-secondary degrees and credentials. We are cutting state funding for higher education. And as a result, tuition at IU Bloomington, for example, has increased by 35% over the last decade. If we are to continue to meet the challenges of our time, we need to invest in post-secondary education. The average college student in 2019 is not living in dorms and going to frat parties down in Bloomington or West Lafayette or any one of the college towns across our state. The average college student is going to community college and working on average over 30 hours a week. The average student has obligations in their household from caring for a parent, raising a child, or contributing income to the household to pay the bills. These students are hungry for better opportunities and making great sacrifices to do it. And the fact is that we need them to do it. We need them to do it so our economy has the talent it needs to continue to move forward and produce the jobs that are going to be coming down the line that can provide a self-sustaining wage for people. The six-year graduation rate at Ivy Tech is in the low 30s, however. And students are leaving with debt, and the economy isn't getting the workers that they need. Students simply are by and large, able to access higher education, but in many ways, not able to complete on time because we have built a system that is built for the elite. And the fact that we have more students who are going to college that were never conceived of when the system was created is a challenge for us going forward. The other form of education is informal education. Informal education is the education we learn from social institutions and circles we find ourselves in, not unlike what we're doing tonight. This can be a job or a church or a local diner coffee shop where people hang out, or it could be a fraternal institution. There's many other examples. In the year 2000, Robert Putnam published a book called Bowling Alone, where he pointed out the significant drop in membership in civil society like churches, fraternal orders, labor unions, and yes, bowling leagues. This was the linchpin of America's conversation with folks who might educate them on who they are voting for, how to get a deal on an item that they regularly buy at the hardware store, or where the place is to go fishing on the weekend. These are settings in which we learn how to use the skills we get in formal education to a practical purpose and actually exercise citizenship. You may know how to do arithmetic, but applying it to balance a budget as you serve on your local school board is essential for society to continue to function. There's a lot more I can say about this, but to summarize and say that this is where we learn why someone decides to put their shirt on with the hangers on the opening to the, on the left, except on the right. And so, Sam, I want to hear your explanation here in a little bit. I want to make a few observations, and then I'll conclude, and I very much want to open up to some questions and conversation. My observation is we need to invest in higher education. Community colleges are the engine of our economy and should be funded like K-12 education in an era where a college education is no longer a luxury to be earned, but a necessity for our economy, both for the individual and for the collective. We need to deliberately invest in civic society. This doesn't have as easy of a public policy associated with it. However, it does mean that we need to find ways to come together unpurposefully so that we can understand why each other decided to hang the hanger the way they did. And we need a lower stakes environment than the public discourse around a presidential election to do so, to truly understand why people do what they do without necessarily an agenda behind it. Tying social capital to formal education is a solution that has long been used by our society. For instance, the GI Bill for the post-World War II generation provided millions and millions of dollars for higher education. If anyone is familiar with IU Bloomington, most of the campus is really a creation of what happened after World War II and all of the buildings that were constructed to deal with the influx of students coming in. We need to consider a GI Bill for the 21st century. You contribute to civil society and we'll pay for your tuition to higher education is an idea I want you to think about. We need to blend formal and informal education on purpose, but also out of necessity. No longer should you think about school as a defined time period, formal education as being this defined time period that you do until you reach 22 years old, and then you work the rest of your life. I think that era is over. And I think more and more people are going to take as we get more and more students who are not affluent going to college, that we need to offer the opportunity for students to do it in stages. For instance, I think it's perfectly rational for a student to go right out of high school, get a certificate, work for 3 years, go back, get an associate's degree, work for a few more years, and then pursue a bachelor's degree after that. That's a really rational way of approaching it, actually, and much more in congruence with kind of the how people mature and how people approach life. I think that is gonna become increasingly common, and we need to create the institutions and we need to create the social understanding for how that can happen. Although most of us in this room, including myself, might have gone to college right when you were 18 years old, graduated when you're 22, and went right into the workforce. That is a luxury that fewer and fewer college students have the ability to do these days. And we need to be understanding and creating the systems to allow students that flexibility to get an education within a non-traditional time frame. As we construct higher education to meet the needs of this generation, it becomes necessary to blend civics into our educational needs along with the skills that the economy is demanding. As we created a universal high school education, we definitely needed reading, writing, and arithmetic, but our forebears created a space for civics and social studies as well. That may not have a direct tie to what a job could be, but it does have a direct tie to being a good citizen, to being a contributing member of civil society. I think having taught US history, I find it not nearly as important as teaching basic civics, which our high school curriculums have increasingly moved away from. For one, you can test high school history a lot easier than you can test high school civics. And that is a challenge for us to consider in the future, for how we can be good citizens and how we can teach that in our formal education settings is a challenge I'd love to dive into more with you all. Education, both formal and informal, provides the corrective of abuses because it gives us the language to understand the basic rules for which we must navigate the world that has been created here for us here in the United States. It is on purpose giving us the language that we need to be full citizens, but we must also understand how to mold those rules over time to meet our needs. We must understand how the social constructions we create leave some people out of the equation. It's one thing to joke about hangers, but it's another thing when we define those people as rapists and murderers. But we must also look to rebuild the institutions of civil society. We might consider, by offering members to recruit a chance at the formal education, they need to be stable members of our society. So if we want to pull more young people into our civil institutions, there's a bargain to be made. I'm willing to make that bargain. You help me out with my formal education, I'll be a member of your organization. I think that is a basic social compact that we once had that has really frayed. And I think as we have an opportunity to really rethink what that looks like. We might consider that way they can contribute their time, talent, and treasure to churches, fraternal orders, and other civil institutions like it. If Thomas Jefferson can frame up our conversation, I'd like to close out on a bit of a lighter note. Who here is a fan of Tolkien? Hobbit, Lord of the Rings? Okay, we have some fans. Thank you, my fellow nerds. I'm reminded of the quote from the movie adaptation when Gandalf is questioned about bringing a halfling or hobbit on a dangerous journey across the world to take on immense powers. And he responds that some believe that it is only great power that can hold evil in check. But that is not what I have found. I found that it is the small everyday deeds of ordinary folk that keep the darkness at bay. Small acts of kindness and love. Why include Bilbo Baggins, a hobbit? I don't know. Perhaps because I'm afraid and he gives me courage. I am once again honored to be here with you tonight. And after a particularly challenging last week, you all give me courage that we can push back against the darkness with small but meaningful conversations like this. I thank you very much.
All right, and we will circulate the room. My wife will have one microphone, I'll have the other. I'll remind you again, this particular microphone is very directional. So if I hand you this mic to speak and you hold it like this, we won't hear you. It really has to be pointed. And I'll start with the first question. Matt, are you left-handed?
I am.
I knew it. That's why you hang your shirts up that way. Yes, I'm right-handed. And I hang it the opposite direction so that when I go through my closet, I can see the front of the shirt. But if I were left-handed.
And you thought it had something to do with God, right?
God may be a left-handed person.
Well, as you were talking about the shirts, I was thinking, I was sort of helter-skelter with the way I hung up my clothes until I was in the Army. And you learn there, everything is hung the same way. So there's some uniformity. And it reminded me, too, that the way you hang things on hangers, it depends on what the purpose is. Some years back in the garment district in New York City, the clothing would be made and it would be sent from one building to another on clothes racks. While they experienced theft, people would come up and just grab a number of garments. So in order to avoid that, they started alternating the clothes. So purpose may make a difference too. I'm very much in favor of post-secondary education. I'm very concerned, though, and disappointed that in many of our institutions, there's a we've sort of devolved in that we are not we, but the students in many of our schools are unwilling to listen to a point of view that does not conform with their point of view. And traditionally, a university, college or university, was a place to be exposed to new ideas and new information, and we seem to be getting away from that. I welcome your comments.
So, I'll speak to my own experience. I went to college, longer ago now than I'd like to admit. I went between 2003 and 2007, and this is undergrad, and I personally got a chance to meet lots of different people with lots of different perspectives and got a chance to have my beliefs challenged in a way that I thought was really healthy. Speaking to my own experience, I think my college experience was very much what I think you're espousing, that it should be a place for ideas to be exchanged and should be a safe place for people to be challenged and not threatened to not be threatened in a way where they are defensive or disrespected. I think that, to your point, Larry, that most of the time, that's a pretty high ideal, that we're going to come together with strangers and share ideas and be able to all come together and understand one another. That's really, really hard. It's really hard. I think more often than not, those kinds of conversations happen within much smaller groups amongst people that know each other. And I think being challenged and having a space where people can be challenged amongst folks that they're comfortable with and they know is a very valuable thing. We used to have many more institutions where that kind of conversation could take place. I mentioned fraternal orders, and churches, things like labor unions and bowling leagues. That's usually where kind of the democratic process takes place. I think there's a very high-minded idea about that taking place at universities and institutions, and I think that's great to the extent that it can. Where I do think that needs to continue to happen is at the local level. And for whatever reason that I could speculate on, we've really moved away from a lot of those institutions. Church attendance across the country is down, whether it's church, mosque, synagogue, or other place of worship. Bowling leagues, by and large, don't exist anymore. We have gone through a lot of social upheaval, and it's sometimes hard to realize that when you live through it. But we very much have. How many of you live in the same house you grew up in or within a half mile of where you grew up? That wasn't the case for a long time in the United States. A long time in the United States, you lived pretty much where you grew up. And we've had a great deal of social upheaval. And as jobs have brought people around the country, both my parents are from Reading, Pennsylvania, but my father's job took him to Indianapolis, and so I grew up in Indianapolis. That's very weird. It's a very historically weird thing. And there are certain moments in time where that becomes more common in times of upheaval. And the challenge that we have is to try to create those environments and those spaces where we can be amongst people we trust and respect and have conversations formally and informally that we can challenge each other about, that we can learn from each other. I think most things that I learned in life are not have not happened within a school setting or a formal facilitated, moderated discussion. It's usually talking to friends and family and other folks I've met along the way that has challenged me in a way that's shaped me to who I am. And so the more we can invest in spaces that have those kinds of environments, the better, whether it's in higher education or hanging out with you all here tonight. So I don't know if I really addressed what you were getting at, but I wanted to say, hey, I think there's that shouldn't be the only ideal where we can, the only ideal situation where we can exchange ideas. Please.
What I was referring to was the situation in a number of campuses where students will not permit someone to come in to address groups of students because that person may be of a different mindset. So it's I guess an extension of the tribalism that we're experiencing. And if you're unwilling to expose yourself to different ideas, even though up front you may be diametrically opposed, then it seems to me sort of defeating the whole idea of a higher education.
Yeah, there was a real interesting thing that happened in Philadelphia recently among Quakers there at Central Friends School when two of the teachers invited in a Palestinian to speak. And because Central Friends has a high Jewish population, it upset several of the parents. And the Palestinian lecturer, and I think this is what you're getting at, Larry, was uninvited. And the teachers who invited the Palestinian speaker were terminated. They lost their employment. And it is just roiling Quakers in the Philadelphia region now who are having to deal with the fallout.
Well, was that Palestinian teacher at Quaker College, too?
Yes, yeah. So I think that's your concern. And let me segue that into my question then, which is, what's up with the politicization of education? Where if we're all recognizing that it's something that's important and that we have, why are so many of our leaders denigrating education and dismissive of education and enacting policies that strip it of its funding so that we can make sure our kids and grandkids are educated? Why do you think that's happening? And do you have a crystal ball to tell us how that might end? Because I'm really concerned about it.
I think that education has always been political. And I think that our highest ideals have been to insulate it from politics. The fact that we have separately elected school boards that are nonpartisan is a pretty radical idea that was created in the progressive era, early part of the 20th century, to insulate education from the machine politics of the era. It's always been political, and I think that it's important to recognize that it's political and to simply say that we believe in education as a method for creating economic prosperity, as it should, and for creating some cohesion in society. The balance to strike there is always understanding cohesion, creating these democratic norms at the same time of respecting our diverse opinions and beliefs. And for a long time, that has been fairly understood, fairly uniform. And as our society gets more diverse, it's continually challenging us to understand how do we educate people and create cohesion in a democratic society while understanding diverse points of view. And it's always been a challenge in America, but it's getting harder and harder because we're becoming more and more diverse, whether it is from a racial point of view, whether it's from a religious point of view, a point of view of heritage, or a point of view of political belief. I think that ultimately there is this marriage of public education that often goes unspoken. That, and one of the points I want to make about in my remarks about saying there was a specific economic reason why universal public high school exists. It is a response to the demand for educated workers to fill the factories of our time. And that was married with this idea of civic responsibility and democratic norms all coming together in the education of an American citizen. It's quite frankly a marriage that's worked quite well for a century or more. As that economic paradigm is shifting, we are rethinking what happens, what is the economic demand and the economic need of our society, and schools have to reflect that. And I think that is a process we're going through in a very, dare I say, awkward way right now. However, we need to be able to also fuse those democratic norms and the civic imperative at the same time as we reconstruct education. So to your challenge, Larry, and what you expounded upon, Phil, I believe that we need to have an open exchange of ideas. I think we need to continue to have really talented educators and people who can understand that balance of a lot of different points of view, while also saying we're gonna create some cohesion and community at the same time. There is not a simple answer, but I think my reflection is that we're going through a bit of a shift, a paradigm shift in education, and we're gonna have to sort that out. We're gonna have to figure out how we address really, really controversial topics like, you know, the conflict in the Middle East. There is no simple way to explain that or no single point of view, but we need to have a healthy conversation within our systems of education, and I, for one, would be in favor of having many different points of view to discuss a situation like that.
All right. Hi. I just wanted to, I guess, Larry, what he was saying earlier about, like, being open to diverse opinions. I think even though our society individually is becoming more diverse, our technology and lifestyle is allowing us to be more segregated. You know, it used to be, and I remember as I grew up just reflecting on this, that some of the people that I became friends with were just a matter of happenstance. You were my suite mate in college. That was totally random. And it's like, I wouldn't have never known you or met you. And quite frankly, if I had to pick who I wanted to be my suite mate, it might not have been you. But because by chance I was put there, you know, I learned things about you and opened up my viewpoint. Nowadays, you don't have that. Young people are communicating online, and they tend to congregate to groups that think like they do. And if somebody wanders in that's different, they're quickly shouted out. When my children went to college, they took a Myers-Briggs personality test to help pair them up with the perfect roommate. Which, I mean, that's good. I'm not saying that's necessarily bad, but by the same token, if we are systematically removing opportunities for conflict that we have a vested interest in sorting out, right? If I have to live with this person, you know, I have to work it out. And I just think we're kind of self-segregating a lot. And I don't know, I think that's in large part due to technology and the internet and the virtual nature of so much of people's social life nowadays. Mm-hmm. And I don't really have any answers. It's just a concern that I have. And I think that's one of the things that keeps people from being open to new ideas and being willing to listen, because they're not in situations where they have to anymore. You know, when I was a kid, I ran around my neighborhood and played with whoever's parents happened to decide to live on that street. You know, I didn't have the whole world of people to socialize with. So I just think that's something to keep in mind.
I'd like to shift the discussion. I'm Annie Johnson. I'd like to shift the discussion a little bit to high school. The high school environment now is, it's far from really being any kind of community. I mean, there's this faux community that pep rallies and stuff like that, but there's a lot of conflict in most high schools, and problems aren't being dealt with a lot of times in any real way. It's just suspensions. There's two systems that are being experimented with and having a lot of success. One is restorative justice, and the other one is collaborative proactive systems. You may not be familiar with collaborative, or they call it CPS, which is a terrible name because it's also Child Protective Services everywhere. But it's basic,
both, yeah.
Its most basic tenet is there are no assholes. So your kid's not being an asshole. He's got a problem and you need to figure out what it is. Now, I think probably there are exceptions to that, but I think they're few and far between. And it's very difficult, first, to get your mind around it and really do it. We have a person who goes to church here who is working in this system, and she says it's really hard to do. But she says it's also really rewarding. And then the restorative justice just says that, you know, when you do something to harm another person, then you do restoration for that. And in the process, you learn to know the person, and you learn. So I wanted to get your thoughts on those, to whatever extent you can.
So my wife, who's an educator, I would probably defer to if she was up here. My restorative justice, CPS, these are, I think, steps in the right direction of creating a behavior system and justice policy that allows for more nuance and the struggles that the student brings into the building, rather as opposed to in trying to be more trying to adjust a bit to the student situation as opposed to forcing the student to adjust to the school situation. I think that my general observation about this are that it's not the policy as much as it is the execution. I think the biggest struggle in high school education is that you have to create culture within a building, and if it's a large, diverse group of students in a building, that's really hard. And it takes time and effort and requires extraordinary feats of educational prowess. The hardest job I've ever had and the hardest job I probably ever will have was as a 11th grade high school history teacher. And the idea that I could fit a particular policy on behavior that someone cooked up outside of a school and make it work in my classroom setting, that's really hard and requires a lot of training, a lot of dialogue back and forth, and a lot of unique culture building within a particular school.
Yeah, I didn't say it was easy.
No. I think that the execution is the key there. I think there are several good and promising new approaches, but oftentimes in education, I think we skip to the next new thing, and we really have to be willing to upend the system, but then once we decide to all put our hangers facing to the right, we got to kind of do that for a while to let the system play out. That takes enormous patience, and sometimes a lot of these things need to be implemented better and be given a lot more time to be implemented well. And you need to get the educators to buy in, and that's really hard because they've been they've had a lot of different systems thrown at them lately.
I would think that both of these would be implemented from the bottom up, from elementary school up through. And that would be a lot easier.
I mean, you're talking 10 years or more to see that fully come to fruition. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
My concerns are somewhat more basic, I think, and it's based on a couple of two personal experiences I had. I grew up loving school, liking learning, until I went to law school, and I hated law school. And I was lucky because I had two professors that understood. One was adamantly against the Socratic method. And that's off and on got me to wonder about, aren't there other methods? And maybe there's too many students to try to address individual learning styles. Then the next piece of this that I saw that was really concerning to me, I was a public defender in Marion County, and I had a pretty large number of clients who could barely read and write, but they had been to the 9th, the 10th, the 11th grade of high school. Is them, or is there an approach, and can we consider approaches to reach people that might not really respond well to a traditional method of teaching?
So the thing I would say to that is, I think that we need to have, you know, just like I talk about different timeline for, you know, post-secondary education, I think we need to be willing to go and have different settings for that formal education to take place. I think there's actually some really innovative approaches taking place within Department of Corrections in the state of Indiana in terms of providing opportunities for folks in the system to get skills and training to better transition into living outside of the Department of Corrections. There's a long way to go there, but I actually think there are some really promising means to help get more of the folks in the system some skills to better transition. I think that the challenge is, of course, trying to work with folks so that they don't wind up in the system in the first place. And we need to have a better handle on data, first and foremost. One of the things I'm working on right now as executive director of India Achieves is building, you know, there's a lot of talk about big data and the evils of big data. And I think that's really, really important to keep in mind and to help guard against. But, you know, sometimes it's the not so well-meaning actors that are the first to seize upon an innovation and take advantage of it, whether it be for manipulating elections or some other insidious means to try to sell you a product. We've really only scratched the surface when it comes to education in terms of how we actually utilize data. So I'll give you an example. Three biggest reasons students drop out of high school. It's not rocket science. There's been a plethora of research on this. There's lots of nuance, and they've, you know, done peer review in a whole nine yards. Reason students drop out of high school boils down to attendance, behavior, and grades. If you've got a red flag in any one of those three areas, we've got the data to see when students are getting into trouble from a behavior aspect, whether they're not showing up to class, whether they're failing a course in their ninth grade year. What we don't know is how to utilize that data and intervene in real time. And we have the data capability now, but we have not built out the systems to respond in a meaningful way. So what we're working on right now is we want to see every single Marion County ninth grader who's failing their ninth grade math class at the fall break. We have the ability to actually gather that data. What if we were actually able to say, hey, you know, Principal Smith, here are the 87 students at your school who are failing math at the first quarter grades. How about we work with all these students in a more meaningful way so that they don't fail by the end of the semester? Or, I think more practically, hey, here are the 27 students who've missed more than 5 days of school this month. Something's going on with these kids. can we call and find out? Can we figure out if it's a mental health issue, if the family is homeless, if they have food insecurity? We can actually use big data to drill down in ways that I think are far more meaningful and far more responsive to the needs of what people are actually going through right now. That is a challenge I think we have over the next decade in education to actually build out these early warning intervention systems. But that's something I'm really optimistic about, because what we can do is start using the data to find problems earlier on in the pipeline and basically utilize the resources that we have to be far more targeted with it. A lot of interventions and resources out there at really well-meaning and effective nonprofits, biggest problem they have is they can't find their clients. They can't find the students and families that they need to serve. And that's a very solvable challenge, I think. It's not easy, but it's a solvable challenge. And that's something I'm really optimistic about. So I think to your point about how we actually work with folks who are getting into the system, a lot of big data solutions, I think, are on the horizon, and something I'm proud to be doing a small part to work on.
That sounds really fascinating, and it seems like there's a lot of hope in that direction. And I'd like to, as somebody that it took 7 years to get my bachelor's, I would like to get back to the community education that you talked about, where we finance post-high school education on the community level, for community education. And you've obviously thought a lot about that. Could you talk a little more about that?
Particularly with community college, you think? Yeah, one of the reflections I have, so in my introduction, you heard I went to the University of Pennsylvania. And so one of the reflections I have about my own experience is that we have this college-going culture, and it becomes, you've heard this term, college-going culture. Is that something I'm looking for responses, anyone? That's something that's talked a lot about in education these days. We want to create a college-going culture. And that's certainly something that was pushed in my household. Both of my parents came from working-class families, and they were able to go to college in an era when college was very affordable, and they were able to significantly out-earn their parents in terms of economic returns. And that was something they were, one, very proud of, and something they were very, very adamant about passing on to me and my sister. And they were pounding into our heads from the time I was a little kid, you're gonna go to college. And I was like, I have no idea what that is, but apparently I want it. And that, I think, is, I think there's some, a little bit of elitism built into that that we need to unpack. And I think that we need to provide a lot of different options to students. The idea that we oftentimes sell the elite nature of college to kids. Come on down to campus and see how cool it is to live at IU Bloomington. IU Bloomington's awesome. But that's not the reason you go to college, and that's not the only setting for college. I think community college, if you go to Ivy Tech Community College and get a certificate in advanced manufacturing and get employed right away, you're in a pretty good economic situation. Now, I would say that shouldn't be where you stop, that getting a certificate in advanced manufacturing and earning a typical wage in that sector when you're 19 years old is a pretty good spot to be in from a pure economic standpoint. When I graduated college at 22 and I was $25,000 in debt, I wasn't in a very good economic situation. I was hoping for a payoff on that, and that's slowly but surely paid off for me. But there's multiple paths there, and I think we as a society need to be talking about those different options, saying, hey, go and get a certificate, and so you can earn a higher wage and earn a better job while you're going to school is something we need to be providing as an option to students. A good example I've heard lately is Area 31, the technical school at, housed at Ben Davis. They had a student who was an excellent student there who went and got her her license in cosmetology. And the counselors there said, what are you doing? You're really smart. You've got these great grades. Why are you going into cosmetology? And the counselor really had to check themselves because she said, well, I want to be able to get a good job so I can make enough money so I can go to college. And the counselor really had to back up a second and say, okay, wait, I am putting a lot of my societal and cultural expectations on the student. And that's actually a really smart way to go about it, to say rather than working a minimum wage job or a fairly low paying job like what a lot of college students are forced to do, that student said, hey, I'm gonna get a credential so I can get a better job and I can pay off school and she doesn't have to wind up $25,000 in student loan debt like I was.
Okay, we'll have to make this one our last one, but we'll carry on downstairs.
Since we were here last, Phil, if I may step off topic a little bit, Phil has been to the original Chautauqua, weren't you? And can you tell us a little bit about that and how it compared to what we're doing?
Yeah, it was a great deal of fun. And they're facing the very same challenges that we brought up. This is an institution that started for the purpose of educating Sunday school teachers, not about religion, but about general science, opera, music, art, so that they in turn could teach children who didn't have access to public education, because we didn't have a robust public education system. Now, their biggest challenge is that they cater to the elite. That if you want to go to Chautauqua and have a cottage there, you're going to pay about $800,000 for a summer cottage. And this is true of almost all the Chautauquas that are set up around the country. And so it has become a very privileged kind of activity. You have to have money to participate in it. And it's really starting to be disconcerting to them, because they have fewer and fewer people who can sustain that. So now they're trying to return to their roots and get more people, a broader spectrum of people to come and participate in both the lectures and the participants. And they're using some pretty innovative things by encouraging people to make their cottages available for very low cost, so other people can come and participate. And they think if they don't do that, the Chautauqua movement will die. That it will die simply because it's too expensive. And if I were in college in America today, I'd be worried about the same thing, that they're pricing themselves out of a market.
Yep.
But all in all, it was a wonderful experience. I just wish all that money had translated into a higher lecture fee, which it didn't do. But it was still fun. I have one thing to say in closing. It's really interesting about Area 31, which my son went through. Marriott hotels are now building pod hotels. Their newest hotel under construction is in Manhattan. And it is a pod assembled off-site and by skilled construction workers, because there are not enough skilled construction workers to do an on-site construction of a new hotel. So that if they can concentrate those workers in one place in America, build each room as a pod, ship it to the site, and erect it there, they can do it. So there's this huge dearth of qualified workers because we've really been pushing people toward college when we should be pushing people toward some more traditional skills.
So if I could reflect on that really quickly, and I know we're gonna close here. I think that skills like the trades are enormously important, and I hope you walk out of here hearing that I am in favor of this, and I want to push students towards skilled trades. Certainly our partnership with Ivy Tech is helping generate a lot of people who have these kinds of credentials. I think in part we're pushing students towards college, but in part students aren't, I think students of my generation and younger, we're doing that for a reason. We're moving towards college for a reason, and not because we're not tough enough or not willing to do construction, but we know that construction, for instance, is very cyclical. And that creates a lot of economic insecurity. And having graduated from college and gone right into the height of the Great Recession, it's a lesson a lot of us learned the really, really hard way. And so these are skills that I think are needed, but I think that students are responding to the fact that there is a great deal of uncertainty and a great deal of cyclical ups and downs to an industry like construction. Now, people can get great jobs and great stable jobs in construction or many other skilled trades. But I think the lesson we also need to learn from the economic upheaval we're in right now is that people need transferable skills. They need skills that they can take from job to job, and they need skills that they can continue to stack upon as they get older. I think that is the reality that we're in right now. And I think we've done a lot of people a disservice by saying, you get a job at Carrier and you've got a job for life. And that hasn't worked out well for some people. So I think that the idea of pushing education and credentials post-secondary, I think is the more nuanced and more accurate way to talk about that. That it shouldn't, when I talk about college, I'm talking about, you know, everything from a industry recognized credential at Ivy Tech or Vincennes or somewhere else to a bachelor's degree and beyond. Like there's a wide range of things there. But I guess I just want to push back a little bit of the idea that like students are being led astray. Like I think students are responding to a lot of the economic realities we've had to live through as well. And the idea that they could be more economically stable and more secure, the more transferable skills that they have and the more credentials that they have, I think is also a pretty healthy approach too. So I very much appreciate the time to come and speak to you all. I look forward to meeting some of you all downstairs. And if anyone thinks I said something crazy, let me know. I want to hear from you.
Thank you so much, Matt.
Thank you.
And I do want to give Matt and his family a chance to get downstairs before he gets cornered up here. We have refreshments downstairs. I think Matt has earned his cookie tonight. So, give him a chance to get down there, and please, please join us downstairs. In fact, as an added incentive tonight. But wait, there's more. If you go join us downstairs tonight, there's the added incentive of some fresh garden-grown tomatoes down there. And as with the service, we're not taking up a collection. They are a free will offering. The funds go toward an educational program, which there's some information written out down there, I believe, isn't there, Annie? So please join us downstairs for refreshments and further conversation. Thanks.